Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Right, you're right, and that's why the country can afford it. The country can afford it. Don't worry about that going broke. Don't worry about that.
Only industrial country in this world.
In this
that
world.
That doesn't have health care. What the hell
and
is wrong
we are
with
the only country in the world where leaders come from every other country to get health care when they can't get the right kind of health care in their own country.
We have in putting together a series on civility, we learned it's rather easy to find examples of incivility. There's always a soundbite available of somebody yelling about something. Finding an example of civility in action is a bit more difficult. It exists, certainly, but sometimes because it is understated or even hardwired into us, we tend to overlook it. So for an example of civility, I kept on thinking of Robert Fulghum's 1988 poem, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Most of what I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sandpile at Sunday school. These are the things I learned. Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your own mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Wash your hands before you eat. Flush. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Live a balanced life. Learn some and think some, and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. When you go out into the world, watch out for traffic. Hold hands and stick together. Be aware of wonder. Robert Fulghum's 1988 poem, All I Really Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. Consider that a palate cleanser and also a list to add to. In partnership with Mass Humanities, we are presenting a three-part series entitled Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse. As we did yesterday, and we will continue today and tomorrow during this 10 a.m. hour, we'll look to explore the issues, concepts, and themes of civility and incivility. In this hour, we'll speak with a quartet of voices from the front lines. Tomorrow, we'll open up our phone lines and invite you to join us for an in-depth discussion with a pair of scholars. For day two of the series, we look at civility, tolerance, and expectations. We'll explore the issues of tolerance and how we can remain civil. We'll discuss the psychological, cultural, and societal forces that help shape our personal levels of civility, the language of civility, and what we expect of others in return for our civility. We'll consider issues of entitlement, media effects, and even sports. Widely recognized for research on the intuitive foundations of morality, Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business, uses moral psychology to understand hyperpartisanship in American politics. But he says we are far from wanting to go back to the, quote, good old days.
So first, on the positive side, let's keep a few things in mind. One is that American politics has been divided and rough and tumble and full of lies and nasty editorials by Thomas Jefferson and other founders. So it's always, our politics has always been rough. It at times has included some violence. It's quite remarkable to me that however bitter things are, pretty much nobody has gotten killed. There's essentially no violence. So that's one way in which we're getting it right. If democracy is about how we live together despite our differences, the fact that there's no violence, despite big things being debated passionately, is really a mark in our favor. We're not so far gone. A second point to note is that our basic psychology is built for group interactions, intergroup conflict, but also group reconciliation. Our ancestors have been very, very good at dividing into teams to fight each other, but then also at burying the hatchet. And so we've certainly saw that after 9/11. Our parents or grandparents saw it during World War II. Americans, like other people, can come together when there's a superordinate goal, when there's an outside attack. So we do have the resources to bury our differences or at least work together despite them.
Is the ultimate goal objective reality?
No, I don't think there's much hope of getting people to get closely in touch with objective reality. The miracle of modern civilization is that we can create these, I call them moral matrices, like the movie The Matrix. Reality is a social construction. We create a moral order, a religious order, a political order. You know, there's a joke among psychiatrists. Neurotics create castles in the air and psychotics live in them. Well, in that sense, we're all psychotics. We're all living in an order that is not objective reality. Even scientists, while I think we're better at getting in touch with reality because we have a system in which we challenge each other, even scientists, it turns out, when they have crucial values or sacred values, can lose touch with it. The goal of our political institutions, I think, should be to help us disagree more civilly and more productively. If you have one person trying to make up all the laws and provide direction for society, it's a disaster. Democracy has trumped autocracy in almost all of the world, but democracy is messy. It's not about reality. It's about how do you channel that disagreement to make it productive.
You study moral psychology. Tell us a little bit about what that is and how it plays into how we view civility now and have in the past.
So there's long been a view that people are basically rational or could be if they worked at it. That goes back to Plato. There's a sub-view within philosophy, beginning especially with David Hume, that we are creatures of passion and intuition. As a psychologist, I think that Hume was right, and my own research has been studying the intuitions that drive our moral judgment and our moral reasoning. So I began by looking at how moral intuition varies across cultures and countries, like in India and the USA. And I found that a lot of the differences, this is drawing from work by an anthropologist, Richard Schwader, a lot of the differences that you see between traditional and more modern secular societies are actually similar to what you see between left and right in this country. So my research and my colleagues at yourmorals.org, we've found that liberals, people on the left in this country, tend to prioritize issues of care and compassion and then also fairness as a quality. And they try to build the whole moral and political order on that. And, you know, if the top 1% has much more money, well, and people are hungry, well, we need to raise taxes, we need to be compassionate towards the poor. Conservatives, on the other hand, while they certainly have compassion and a sense of fairness, what we find is that they also value group loyalty, respect for authority and tradition, and have more of a sense of sanctity or purity. So a lot of our culture war issues hinged on those issues. Certainly back in the 90s, those social issues, you know, flag burning, amending the Constitution to protect the flag, abortion, rap lyrics, all these things, these social debates were about competing sets of intuitions. Nowadays, since the economic collapse and the rise of the Tea Party, those social issues have taken a back seat. Libertarians and social conservatives formed a team, and that made they had to bury the social issues then, otherwise they'd lose the libertarians. And now our debates as a country are around economic issues, which are still moral issues. They're issues about fairness. Is fairness equality, or is it proportionality? Is it right to bail out companies? Is it right to bail out people who have failed or who have become unemployed? So left and right disagree. Everybody thinks they value fairness, but left and right have different notions of fairness and of the government's role in altering the state of affairs.
How much do you think we, the people, mirror what we see on a political stage? So as we've seen that change over the course of say, the 20th century, how much of it is us mirroring them, or that they are, in the truest sense of our founding, representing us?
There's a lot of debate among political scientists on that question, and I'm not qualified to weigh in. I can just make a few observations. One is that most Americans are fairly apolitical. Most Americans are somewhere in the center. They don't really know what's going on. They don't really care what's going on. So most Americans aren't – America's not that polarized if you look at all of the people. We're still a center or possibly center-right nation. But those who are politically active, the political elites have gotten much more polarized. We certainly see that in Congress. There is no doubt that Congress is far more polarized than it has been since the Civil War era. There used to be overlap between the most liberal Republican was often to the left of the most conservative Democrat. There was quite a lot of overlap. I've seen graphs recently showing that in the last few years that basically ended. Now there's no more overlap in either chamber. So Congress has definitely polarized a lot, especially in the House. Things started there, and the norms changed for a lot of other reasons. Newt Gingrich introduced some reforms that ramped up inter-party hostility. So there's no doubt that the elites have gotten much more polarized, much less able to work together, particularly in the House. And then the question is, has this caused the people to get more polarized, or are they responding to changes among the people? I think the causality goes both ways, but I do think that elite polarization kind of got things started. I should add, though, that the background to all of this is an amazing sort that has happened to us once the once President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. He set in motion a process which he knew was going to happen, as he said on the day he signed it to Bill Moyers, "I've just signed over the South to the Republican Party for the rest of my lifetime and yours." So there used to be conservative Southern Democrats because Lincoln was a Republican. Once the Civil Rights Act was signed, the South started going to the Republican Party. And then once the Republican Party got much more conservative, it alienated its few remaining liberals. We've seen the last of them depart, like Olympia Snow just very recently. The Democrats became much more liberal. Along with that political sort, we've seen a gigantic sort by urban-rural. And so there used to be a lot of conservative working-class folks living in cities, socially conservative folks in cities. But we've had a gigantic lifestyle sort. So now the best predictor of politics is actually population density. In the last election, if you lived in a county that had more than 800 people per square mile, the very strong odds were you voted for, your county voted for Obama. Below 800 people per square mile, it was Romney. So we have the populace sorting by lifestyle. People who live in dense areas tend to have more liberal values and support more of a role for government, and vice versa for those who live in rural areas. So we have this big sociological change happening, which is certainly contributing to driving a lot of the effects we see in Congress, especially in the House. So causality goes both ways.
And also in the issue of causality, there is, you look at our media landscape in a time where there used to be three or four networks that were centrist, and now you expand that times 1,000, and it is all over the board.
That's right. So there are so many pieces contributing to this. There is no one explanation. Changes in politics, changes in demography, increases in immigration and diversity, and the one you just mentioned, a very changed media landscape. All of these are major contributors to our rising polarization. On the media front, I think causality is clearly both ways. Because of technological and legal constraints, the few television networks were required by law to air the other side of a debate. And so they stayed away from politics. And when they did, when I was a kid, I remember seeing somebody coming on and just, you know, very low production values, a guy sitting there spouting off on why he disagrees with some policy. Once you had the technological breakthrough of cable TV, I understand the reasons why that old policy had to disappear. So clearly there was a market for more stratified or niche broadcasting, and people tune into it, and the broadcasters, like the newspapers, are responding to the mass market. At the same time, as you have the incredible rise of money trying to influence policy, and this is related to our rising inequality, when you do have the wealthiest people have far more money, far more access to power and legislation, yes, they're going to spend money hiring extremely sophisticated media consultants to try to influence the debate. Now, left and right both spend enormous amounts. It's not that the right has a monopoly on this by any means. But clearly the media is a big piece of the puzzle, and it's one of the hardest. Because of the First Amendment and market forces, I've seen very few suggestions for ways that we can reduce the impact of media on polarization.
Back to moral psychology, and it comes to this idea of large-scale cooperation. Are you optimistic that that can happen?
No, not really. Large-scale cooperation comes about best when there's a foreign attack. And I am so glad that we live at a time, well, of course, there was the 9/11 attack, but the possibility of major wars, of world wars, which were so severe for my parents' generation. And when I was a kid, I really thought that there could be a nuclear war during our lifetimes. You know, there can be terrorist attacks, but it's very, very unlikely that there can be a world war or nuclear war or anything really big like that, thank God. We live in a time of general prosperity and freedom, and that tends to encourage individualism and individuals to pursue their own aims. I don't see much that's going to unite Americans. Things like global warming aren't going to do it. As long as one side embraces the threat more than the other, then it actually becomes a cause of division rather than unity. So I don't see much possibility of Americans all coming together to accomplish something great. What I am hoping is that there will be a major political realignment. I think the Republican Party has an expiration date on it because of the demographic factors, as we all saw in the last election, with the rise of Asian and Latin American populations in this country. The demographic base of the Republican Party is declining and declining and declining. So something will have to change in a very big way for the Republican Party. It'll have to lose some of its power base in the social conservative South. When that happens, I think both parties will change, and then the logjam could be broken. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. A moment ago, Professor Haidt mentioned moderate Republican Senator Olympia Snowe leaving politics. We'll speak with her when we come back. Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse is funded in part by Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, masshumanities.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.